This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. How well do you know your own mind? Is it possible that you sometimes reach conclusions that are not true? Or that you even sometimes find yourself seeing things that are not really there? Most of us would admit to having had such experiences, but here's the rub. Could it be that over thousands of years, the human brain evolved in a way that makes it likely for you to mistake what you think you see and to believe what is not real? A Virginia psychiatrist makes exactly that case in his new book. In an amazingly concise, easy-to-read volume, the author reviews more than two decades of modern brain function science. His conclusion? Belief in religion may stem from a dysfunctional byproduct of evolution. The book is titled, Why We Believe in Gods. Our conversation with author Andy Thompson begins right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The book is titled, Why We Believe in Gods, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. Its lead author is a staff psychiatrist at the University of Virginia's Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy, a specialist in forensic psychiatry, a researcher in the field of evolutionary psychology, a therapist in private practice, and also serves as a trustee of the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, J. Anderson Thompson, Jr. Andy, welcome back to Virginia Insight.
Thank you for having me.
I got to ask, is the point of this book that anyone who believes in God is somehow deluding themselves?
In a sense, yes.
You're going to stop there? You're going to tell me more?
I'll be glad to tell you more.
Good.
That science now shows us the mechanisms by which the human mind generates religious belief. Why we construct gods, why we construct the kind of gods we do, why we believe in them, why we spread the belief. And what is, to me, so interesting about it is the mechanisms are common, ordinary, everyday mechanisms that evolved in our brain to negotiate our social world. And they come together to form religious belief. And anyone who's interested in understanding it can. The science doesn't require any specialty knowledge. A curious individual can master it, I think, in a couple of hours, can really fully understand the basics and be able to turn around to somebody later that day and explain it to them.
You realize that conclusion is going to be hard for many people to take and at least a little bit controversial.
Absolutely. And part of what the science shows us is that we are, in a sense, natural-born supernaturalists. We're natural-born creationists. There's certain aspects of our mind that evolved to help us survive that make us vulnerable to supernatural beliefs, that make us vulnerable to creationist beliefs, that it's just one small step from these ordinary mechanisms to religion.
You talk a lot early on in the book about evolution, about how over thousands of years human beings got to be who and what we are today. And you talk some about evolutionary byproducts. And I think the first example you gave of an evolutionary byproduct has to do with why most people love fast food. So let's start there.
Yes, I think if you understand the psychology of junk food, if you understand the psychology of the Big Mac meal, you understand the basic psychology of religion. We evolved in harsh, dangerous environments in Africa. We all have cravings for fat, but that original craving for fat was for lean game meat that we had to chase, to catch, that was rare, but it was crucial. Great source of protein, and all of us have the legacy of that. We have a craving for fat. We all have a craving for sweets. Sweets were originally ripe fruit. Again, rare but crucial. Crucial source of calories, crucial source of vitamin C. None of us crave broccoli because tubers were plentiful, but they weren't a particularly good source of calories. So we are all left with that ancient appetite, that ancient craving. And it, again, is for primarily fat and sweets. And we were left with an appetite that was designed for harsh, dangerous environments where plentiful food was non-existent. Starvation was always right around the corner. So we have these. So if there was fat and sweets around, we ate it. Now, what the modern world gives us is a cultural byproduct. It's a byproduct of these cravings. And they give it to us in super normal stimuli. We don't get ripe fruit. We get Coca-Cola. We get brownies. And they give us a much bigger hit of pleasure. They're a super normal stimuli. Similarly, we don't have lean game meat. We have fat, juicy hamburgers, which, you know, I love them like anybody else. Or a juicy steak that's just full of marbled fat. And it gives us a super normal stimuli. So the Big Mac meal you want to think of as a monument to your Stone Age inheritance. And it arises from these old adaptations, these cravings, but it comes to us in a new and novel form that's a super normal stimuli.
And before we get to how these factors mirror what happens with human psychology that you say leads to people deluding themselves to believe in God and believe in religion, let's talk a little bit about adaptation. I think one of the things that you must be saying is that all those thousands of years ago when our ancestors were on the plains of Africa where food was scarce, something must have happened so that human beings would end up over time automatically craving fat, automatically craving sweets.
Exactly. And adaptation is a problem solver. It's a problem solver that evolved over long periods of time. My heart is an adaptation. It solves the problem of pumping blood. Hemoglobin is an adaptation. It solves the problem of transporting oxygen. Your lungs are an adaptation. They solve the problem of extracting oxygen from the air. Now, similarly, the mind is what the brain does, and the brain is this integrated collection of adaptations which solve particular problems. And the craving for fat solves the problem of getting those crucial sources of protein.
So that my great-great-grandfather times 1,000, he was the one that had the adaptation in his genes that made him not only have a really intense craving for fat and for sweets and maybe for salt as well, and he got a real hit of pleasure whenever he was able to consume those things. And he also had an intense desire to consume as much of them as he could on the rare occasions that he found them. And so he survived while people with him who did not have those adaptations did not survive.
That's a nice summary.
He was the one who would have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Right. It's the adaptations that promote survival and reproductive success that become part of the organism.
Okay, so here's where it gets difficult, because you mentioned numerous ones of these about how you say the human brain evolved so that it gave us certain kinds of desires that relate to why we would believe in religion. And one of the first ones that you mentioned, I think, Andy Thompson, is the importance of attachment?
Yes, the attachment system. And I'm particularly fond of this one because this comes really from University of Virginia, Mary Ainsworth, the psychologist at University of Virginia, who, with the British psychiatrist John Bowlby, mapped out the attachment system in human beings. And it's not just humans. It's other mammals and primates. When we're in distress, we turn to an attachment figure. Attachment systems are crucial for parent-child interaction. But we also use part of the attachment system with friends, with our romantic partners. But the most intense attachment is child and mother, child and caretaker. And that's a hardwired part of our brain. It's a very crucial adaptation. It solves the problem of parental care. When an infant is distressed, of turning to a caretaker, to a parent. And so you see that religion gives us supernormal parents. It gives us a God who has powers that our parents could never have.
The book is titled Why We Believe in Gods, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. Its lead author, psychiatrist Andy Thompson is our guest. This is Virginia Insight, coming to you today from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville. I'm Tom Graham. I suspect that you may want to listen to a little bit more of what Dr. Thompson says about these adaptations and how he believes these lead us to delude ourselves when it comes to belief in anything supernatural. But if at some point you have a question for him or a comment in response to what you're hearing, you are welcome to call in at any time at 888-WMRA-TALK, that's 888-967-2825. We are also accepting questions and comments posted on our Facebook page, which you can find listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. The other biggie that I got from your book, Andy, about what leads us to where you say we are prone to believe in something that isn't there, is what I think you called the mind-body split, another adaptation?
Yes. All of us think about our own feelings, wishes, desires, the non-physical attributes of ourselves, our beliefs, our intentions, in the middle part of our brain, the midline, in your frontal lobe. When we think about our own body, our faces, somebody else's body, that is processed in the lateral part of our brain. There is literally a mind-body split in the very architecture of our brain. And if you think about it, that would be important, because it's important to be able to think about somebody else without them literally sitting in front of you. And so it allows for us to think about and to have a complex interaction in our heads with somebody who's not present.
And part of that adaptation then over time with thousands of years of evolution is that people who do that well, who have that split, are more social, are more likely to get along in groups.
Yes, it's part of our ultra sociality. The hallmark of human beings as opposed to other hominids was probably our capacity for intense sociality. We're an intensely social species. And part of that is because you and I can remember conversations that we had with somebody in the past. We can think about future conversations we need to have with that individual. And we do that seamlessly and easily. But it doesn't take much. Again, this is one more example where you see that religion is just one short step away from something that's everyday, ordinary cognition. And it doesn't take much to think about and have a conversation with, for instance, someone who is deceased. And we can call them up in our mind, and they're just as alive in our mind as they were when they were actually alive. And so you can see a conversation with a dead ancestor or a worshipped ancestor is very easy. And of course, it's very easy to have a conversation with a god. What is a god? A god is a mind that isn't present. It's a human mind, a human-like mind that is not physically present. And so you can also see, I hope, that this leads very easily to the concept of souls. Built into our brains is a sense of life separate from a body.
Because the mind we think of as separate from our body.
Absolutely.
Even though you say there's no doubt in your mind that the mind is simply what the brain does.
Exactly. And all of us have evidence of that. You know, when we get a hit on our head, the functioning of our mind gets disrupted. Our mind just doesn't keep going along unaffected when our brain gets bonked.
There's one other important adaptation that you say relates to why people tend to believe in gods and religion that I want to get to before we hit the break if I can. You note that people may mistake a shadow for a person. I think you say you might mistake a shadow for a burglar, but nobody ever mistakes a burglar for a shadow. Something
exactly.
About having a tendency to believe that something is there, some sort of person or animal is there when they're not.
Yeah, they're called hyperactive agency detection devices.
Hyperactive agency detection devices.
Yeah, so had. We're all had.
Okay. People might be able to guess how that would be adaptive. I don't know if they can guess how that relates to religion, but we have to pause for a 1 minute break, and we'll ask Dr. Andy Thompson to explain when we get back. For you on the other side of your radio, has it ever occurred to you that the manner in which your brain works is a function of evolution? Do you consider it possible that there might be ways your brain operates which may not be as adaptive for human beings in today's world as perhaps it might have been hundreds or even thousands of years ago? 888-WMRA-TALK, that's 888-967-2825 is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Forensic psychologist Andy Thompson is our guest. His new book is titled Why We Believe in Gods, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. And Andy, you would say that no question in your mind, what you have found in science, both the past couple decades of research into evolutionary psychology and what has been done with brain monitoring and understanding brain science and brain function science, leads you to the conclusion that people believe in God because of a maladaptive function of evolution.
Yes. I think, however, that religion probably, at some point in our history, was adaptive. It was not in a biological sense. It was useful. Just like reading and writing has been very useful. Reading and writing is a cultural byproduct. Religion was our original cosmology, was our original explanation for the universe. Religion was our original biology. It explained who we were and where we came from in most cultures. Religions also served as kind of a justice system within groups. It probably had moral force, binding force for groups. So religion was probably very useful in our hunter-gatherer past. But now we have much better understanding of the cosmos, much better understanding of biology, who we are, where we came from. And I think religion has, in some sense, outlived its usefulness.
Going back to what was adaptive, why our ancestors of tens of thousands of years ago survived because of what developed in their bodies and their brains, and some of the people who were living right alongside of them did not survive, at least not long enough to have children. This thing about why it is that if we see a shadow, we may automatically assume that it's a person or a threat. But if we see a person, we never assume that it's a shadow. Explain the adaptation of that and how that relates to people's ability to believe in the supernatural.
Certainly. Most of us have smoke detectors in our house. The smoke detector is set on a hair trigger. And it is that way because if there's boiling water and it goes off, that's an inconvenience. It's a false positive. It's an inconvenience. But if there's a fire in your house and it doesn't go off, that's a false negative, and your house burns down. And so there's a real asymmetry there. So our brains are built similarly, like smoke detectors, in that it's important for us to be able to detect agency, particularly deadly agency. So if I see rustling in the bushes, I better assume that it is a human or animal agent that might be out to get me and to move away pretty quickly.
And the human beings who did that 100,000 years ago were the ones who survived.
Exactly. The ones who said, eh, and just kept walking. And in that bush that was rustling was a tiger or an enemy, they didn't live. And so we have these hyperactive agency detection mechanisms. And we overread agency. We wildly overread agency. If we hear a door slam, we jump, we automatically assume there's an agent.
And not the wind.
And not the wind, exactly. You know, it's a burglar first, you know. The wind is a distant second. And again, to look at religious belief, it's made up of many, many different strands. And what we're looking at is just one strand of many. But these are strands that are all part of our ordinary, everyday cognition, just part of our regular brain.
One more adaptation before we get to some of these Facebook posts. And by the way, for anybody listening to this fascinating conversation with forensic psychologist Dr. Andy Thompson, we are getting lots of questions and comments on Facebook, which means I'm going to have to read them. And it gets really boring to listen to my voice. So if anybody is willing to let us hear your voice, the phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. If you have a question or comment for the author of the new book, Why We Believe in Gods. So this other adaptive factor that you talk about in the book, Andy, has to do with, I guess it's an assumption that most people seem to have as a default, that things have a purpose.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, we overread purpose, and this was probably useful. And many of these adaptations you can see in their clearest form in children. So if you ask a child, what are rocks for? They'll say, for animals to scratch themselves. What are rivers for? For fish to swim in. And they overread purpose. But we still, all of us, even as adults, overread purpose. When I was talking about the heart solves the problem of pumping blood, I'm talking about it as if there's a purpose there. There's an intentional agent, as opposed to the gradual purposelessness process of evolution. And so it is, you take our overreading of agency, our overreading of purpose, it's very easy for us to subscribe to creationist beliefs. And children will spontaneously have creationist beliefs, even if they're raised in non-religious households. And so we're all prone to that kind of thinking.
So let me sum what we've talked about these adaptations, and there are many more that you mentioned in your book. There's the attachment, there's the mind-body split, the ability to imagine what's going on in someone else's mind, you talked a little bit about, automatically assuming that something that we see out of the corner of our eye, a shadow or something, is a person or an animal or a threat of some kind, even an imaginary being, and not just the wind blowing, and a default belief that things have a purpose. Are there any of the other many adaptations that you mention in your book that you think are most important to getting across this theory of yours, that this all comes together to make us easily deluded about belief in God?
Well, one of the other mechanisms is called minimally counterintuitive worlds, and that's a very clumsy title for the following. We're all constantly scanning the environment for something new. We have to be aware of something that's unfamiliar because it may be dangerous, and so we're always looking for that. And one of the kind of kludge mechanisms that's a fallout of that is this minimally counterintuitive worlds, and this is the basis of religions. This is the basis of fairy stories, fairy tales. If I tell you that tree outside the Virginia Humanities Center, that big tree out there, will do your taxes, wash your car, do this radio show for you, you're simply not going to believe me because there's too many violations of tree-ness. Tree-ness, yeah, about what you know about trees.
Okay.
You know, there's just too many violations of that. But if I tell you that tree on the night of a full moon will hear one request and honor it, you might be vulnerable to believing me because there's just one slight twist. There's claiming some kind of human mental agency, but everything else you know about trees is left intact, and so it becomes attention arresting and memorable. And this is the basis of religions and of fairy tales. Little Red Riding Hood. There's just two little twists. The wolf can talk. Little Red Riding Hood and her grandmother survived death. Two little twists. Everything else is the same. There are no other violations of wolfness or people. Look at the Judeo-Christian God. He's sort of physically everywhere, but otherwise it's just a guy. And everything about guys are there unconsciously and just assumed. There are not very many violations. Or another one would be, I think this illustrates it actually a little bit better, Tom. The Judeo-Christian God knows my thoughts. knows if I've been naughty or nice. So that's a little twist, a little violation. But otherwise, everything about humanness is still there, because if I still have to pray to him, I still have to talk to him as another human being. Well, why would I have to talk to him if he knows my thoughts? And so you see the little bit of a twist. He can read my thoughts exactly, but everything else about humanness is left intact, just accepted without even thinking about it. You know, that God can understand my slightly southern accented English, you know, everything else. And these minimally counterintuitive worlds, minimally counterintuitive ideas are the basics, one of the other basics for religion and fairy tales. It's not an adaption per se, but it arises out of that adaption where we're always scanning for the novel in our environment.
Psychiatrist J. Anderson Thompson, Jr. is a trustee of the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. He is also a clinical therapist, a University of Virginia faculty member, and a researcher in the field of evolutionary psychology. Just published in June of this year, his latest book is titled Why We Believe in Gods, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Call in phone number 888-WMRA-TALK. Constance in Shenandoah County, thank you for using that number. Your question or comment for Dr. Thompson, please.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering if your guest doesn't think it's awfully presumptuous to assume that man has stopped evolving and that we are the end of this progression. And in light of that, there's a whole series of books that I'm sure you're familiar with by Daniel Quinn that addresses this. But in light of that, don't all these theories have to be put on hold?
I'm not familiar with Daniel Quinn's work. Yes, we continue to evolve. Also, these mechanisms that lead us to religious belief, I think, are fairly instantiated in human brains. Whether they will change and evolve differently over time, none of us knows. But I would agree with you that we haven't stopped evolving. At the same time, I would say that we know enough about how we have evolved to come up with a fairly comprehensive science of cognitive science of religious belief.
And you don't think that it's based totally on fear and power?
No, I don't. I think it's much more complicated than that.
Constance, if you heard Andy's comments at the beginning of the show, you probably heard him talking about how human beings evolved to have cravings for things like fat and sweets that cause us problems in the world today, because unlike our ancestors, we're now surrounded with easy access to high-calorie, high-fat junk foods. Do you accept that as being a problem in the world today for human beings?
I accept it as a problem. I don't know necessarily that we have evolved that way. I think we are subjected to, for lack of a better word, brainwashing and bombardment of enterprises that sell these commodities. And I would not necessarily attribute that to evolution.
And Andy, I think what you're saying is that we're especially susceptible to that brainwashing because of the cravings we evolved with.
Yes. I'm gonna crave brownies regardless of how much advertising I see on them. And if I see a lot of advertising on them, I'll probably eat a few more of them or crave a few more of them. But the craving is there.
So to take Constance's point one step further, would it be your supposition, Dr. Andy Thompson, that because of these adaptations that you say make us susceptible to the belief in the supernatural, that we get brainwashed by different religions that try to suck us in?
I think that's a fair statement.
Constance, thank you so much for your call. Andy, one of the things that Constance is saying gets me thinking about the fact that you wrote this book because you think that religion in the world today has become a problem. You said there were times in human history where you thought it was adaptive and helpful to the survival of human beings. And it's my understanding that your pursuit of the possible connections between brain science and religious belief came about, at least in part, because of a personal tragedy narrowly averted almost 10 years ago. Can you tell us that story?
Certainly. My son was in the Merrill Lynch building next to the World Trade Center on 9/11 and obviously witnessed the whole nightmare. And there but for, as the old saying goes, there but for the grace of God, could have been killed. And it got me interested in suicide terrorism, the psychology of suicide terrorism. And what was stunning when I started to research it was that there was this whole field out there of the cognitive neuroscience of religious belief and any number of scientists working on it. And it became apparent over the last couple of years that, again, there was just a tremendous amount of research, I thought, a tremendous amount of insight into religion, and there was no one book that seemed to bring it all together and to make it accessible in a short format for a curious reader who didn't have time to read the academic books or the academic papers, and they could pick up this book and in an hour, hour and a half, become completely conversant. And so I talked with a friend and colleague, Claire Alcofer, who's a wonderful editor and medical writer, and we came up with the vision for this book as something that was short, accessible. It would come out in paperback and electronic form, no hardback. It would be cheap. And Kurt Volkan of Pitchstone Publishing loved the idea, and he helped us. And this is what the book is. And
I will give you that it's short and concise and small. I mean, it's short both in height and in number. It's like 116 pages.
Yeah, the idea was you could put it in your pocket. It was literally designed to be able to put in the inside pocket of your sport coat or inside a purse.
And I think the price is just under $13, so it's for a book that reviews this much science, it's fairly cheap. My guess is there are a lot of people who are going to take issue with the things that you say in it, other people who are going to love what you say in it, but nobody can deny that what you say in it is easy to grasp in terms of the writing style and the simplicity with which you review the science. Phone number is 888-967-2825, 888-WMRA-TALK, if you want to talk with forensic psychiatrist Dr. Andy Thompson. Next, we go to Seth in Mount Jackson. Seth, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight.
Hi. My comment...
Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead, please.
Okay. My comment has to do with something that Andy said earlier about religion outliving its usefulness. My first thought is that maybe this myth about that sort of comes to life in Judeo-Christianity and other religions about a sort of a universal idea of God bears a sort of truth that still has lays claim to validity outside of science. So in other words, when it comes to moral questions, religion is something that helps us, that represents a sort of a dialogue that really doesn't always have to do with these metaphysical truths that objective science pursues.
Seth, we have to pause for the break. Let me just clarify. Are you saying that there are religions in the world today that don't work well, but we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater?
Well, all I'm saying is that,
I'm going to have to ask you to hold on and get you to clarify in your own words when we get back from the break, which is going to be in just about 1 minute. The book is titled Why We Believe in Gods, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. Its lead author, psychiatrist Andy Thompson, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So, Seth, it sounds like you were also talking about the importance of morality in religion?
That's correct.
Okay, Andy, your response?
Well, the argument is often made that we need religion to be moral. I think, again, the evidence is overwhelming that that is not true. We have moral systems built into our brain you can start to show them in children as young as 3 months, 6 months of age. Any listener that's interested in this, just Google Paul Bloom, B-L-O-O-M, The Moral Lives of Babies, New York Times Magazine. Wonderful, wonderful article about the research they're doing on this point. And again, we're born moral, and you see moral behaviors. One of my favorite examples is you see evidence of moral behaviors in some of our Homo erectus ancestors long before Christianity.
Seth, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to a couple of these Facebook postings. One is short and to the point. This is from Joni, who says, in response to what she's been hearing from you, love it, what I've been saying all along. And we have a much longer post from Larry, who takes issue with some of what your book says. Let me skip over some of this. Larry says, I do believe that the propensity to worship is an evolutionary development of human beings. Like speech, it is essentially universal, though expressed in different ways in different cultures. However, key to the idea of evolution is that it encourages traits that serve a real purpose. There are many other ways for people to form social bonds, feel comfortable with natural phenomena, and so on. I suggest that we evolve the practice of communicating with gods and spirits because, in fact, they exist and can sometimes help us. Scientists who find some other reason bear the burden of proof. Occam's razor suggests that if almost all human beings engage in a particular practice, there is a good reason for doing so, and it is quite likely the reason is the one that worshiping people believe is true, that they are in contact with a power outside the normal realm. Occam's razor?
Well, I think I would disagree with him on 2 points. First of all, I think it is now the religious that need to show any evidence for God, and I think they would have a hard time doing so. The second thing is the idea of if so many people believe it, it must be true. Well, most people several centuries ago believed that the sun revolved around the earth. And certainly that certainly seemed to be anybody's perception. Clearly, that wasn't true. So just because you believe it doesn't make it true.
Linda in Winchester is on the phone line with us. Linda, your question or comment for the author of Why We Believe in Gods, Dr. Andy Thompson, please.
Thanks. I was really interested in what Dr. Thompson was talking about regarding our search for purpose, both in specific things and in the world around us in general. And that brought two questions to mind. And the first is that there are certainly many people who search for purpose in their own life and why they're in the world that then also question their faith in terms of, as you have brought up, the existence of deities. So is, what are some of the other ways that purpose might manifest itself in just anyone's everyday life? And then the other question I have is more practical, which is, can I get your book on my Kindle?
I'll take the last question first. Yes, you can get it on your Kindle. It's in electronic version. That was part of the idea, is to have it come out cheap and paperback and electronic right off the bat. In terms of purpose, I think two things. First of all, the purpose of life is to make more life. That's the basic biological purpose of life. That's the modern Darwinian synthesis. What purposes or meaning one gives to one's own life is up to the individual. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's the ultimate freedom and much more liberating than trying to structure one's life to placate a tyrant in the sky.
Does that respond to your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda. Andy, you used to be a religious person. At least to some degree, you say in your book that you grew up in a Presbyterian church. You sang in the choir as a young man. You did at least in part because your elders told you religion was a good thing to be doing. At some point in time, you stopped believing in religion. You stopped believing in God. How come?
Probably many factors. I think I wasn't particularly religious, but people who I admired and trusted were religious. That went a long way. And I loved singing in the choir with my friends, loved the music, still do. I think what ended it for me was medical school and seeing terrible human suffering, and that closed the door, because all the stuff that I'd heard about there being a loving God, and you see unbearable suffering, unbearable pain. You see children, back when I went to medical school and there was no cure, you see lovely children dying of leukemia. And the progress against those diseases, the progress against those terrible illnesses, was the outgrowth of very hard work by countless hardworking medical scientists. And to me, that closed the door on any.
One of the ironies for me is that it's my understanding that you went to medical school with somebody who works in just about as opposite a realm of psychiatry and science and belief about the supernatural as is possible, Bruce Grayson, who heads the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia and has worked for many years on documenting near-death experiences.
Bruce and I trained together, we're old friends, and we just disagree.
But what I don't understand, I can see that being raised in a Christian faith, that some point in time you came up against evidence that said to you, what they taught me in this religion doesn't work for me. What I don't understand is how you then jump to the opposite conclusion of the kind of people who are working in Dr. Grayson's field, that there is nothing supernatural out there. Not only is there not a Christian loving God, but the people who have near-death experiences are not really experiencing something metaphysical. The people who in deep states of meditation believe that they're reaching other realms and they're getting guidance that works for them from their spirit guides or whatever. You dismiss all of that.
Well, I think dismiss may be a little bit too strong a word. I would submit to you that I think the evidence doesn't support their claims.
Have you looked at their evidence in
yes,
detail?
Yes, I've read some of it. I'm not an expert, but I know there are, I've read things that dispute and present a different picture about what is going on in the brain at the time of near-death experiences. I'm not an expert in it.
Ed Kelly, who also is a researcher at the Division of Perceptual Studies from the University of Virginia, was on this show some months ago talking about the new book that he and five other scientists wrote together called Irreducible Mind. And they reached completely the opposite conclusion that you talk about in this book, that the mind is not confined by the brain. Dr. Kelly claims there are hundreds of studies that not only support, but in his mind, absolutely prove that point of view. Do you see it as a debatable point, or is this pretty much closed as far as you're concerned? Ed Kelly and people with his viewpoint are just mistaken?
Well, I think the evidence would argue that they are. But I think you want to approach it as a scientific question. I think that one has to, again, examine the research, peer-reviewed, replicated. And I think I've been most influenced by researcher Nicholas Humphrey on this point. But you don't want to treat it as a matter of belief. You want to treat it as a matter of, does the evidence support it or not? And
Harrison in Bridgewater, thank you for so patiently waiting on the line. Your question or comment for psychiatrist and medical doctor Andy Thompson, please.
Well, hi, thank you. And applauding your work here to start with. I mean, the true believer thing has been going on for eons. I've thought for decades that this has more or less been an evolutionary manifestation in our brain. For better or for worse, and when it's for the best, then I have no problem with that. Would you say perhaps? And I just first of all was wondering. This is not exactly a revolutionary idea what you're speaking of, I don't think. But can a person person with a certain level of intellect evolve beyond this predestination to have a need to lead a good life and subjugate themselves to some sort of a fantasy of religion?
I'm not sure I follow your question.
I think what he's saying is we're told that we need to stay away from fat and salt and sugar, even though we can understand the biological reasons why we crave it so. You're saying that there are evolutionary reasons why so many people crave and fall victim to religious fervor. And I think the caller is saying, is that inevitable, or can we resist that just like we can resist too much salt and too much sugar?
Certainly. I think it's education. Knowledge is power. For me, what's exciting is the psychological science, that it turns out that religion is based on everyday cognitive mechanisms that evolved to help us negotiate our social world. I think again, the psychological science is exciting. I think that's what's new. Certainly, people have been questioning the existence of God for centuries. There are many famous atheists and this is a different angle. This is coming at it a different way. And I just think as I said, I think the science is interesting. I think it turns out that it's so easily understood. And for me, that's the nicest part of it. And I think you're right. I think you can move away from it, but we're all still vulnerable.
Harrison, thank you so much for your call. I think we can squeeze in one more caller. Nancy from Harrisonburg, you're on the air with Dr. Andy Thompson.
Hello. I grew up also as a Presbyterian, and then in college in the 60s, I took a Western Civilization class that taught us that the Bible was not to be taken literally. And I wondered what your take is on that. I have been a skeptic ever since that time.
Yes, I think we should teach religion, but I think it should be taught like you learned it, as comparative religion. Religions have great cultural and literary traditions. I wouldn't not teach religion. I would teach comparative religions.
You would teach
and
comparative.
And part of what?
I'm sorry?
You said you would teach comparative religion?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And certainly no one can understand the richness of English literature without having some, I think, knowledge of the King James Bible.
Nancy, thank you so much for your call. We've got just a couple minutes left, Andy. You've made clear how you came to your conclusions about why religion was not for you. And it was some years after that you began to do this research on evolutionary psychology and make the connections between what was found in that field and in brain science that got you to where you believe human beings have an adaptation that makes them susceptible to a false belief in gods. Is it possible that even today, certain kinds of spiritual beliefs, certain kinds of religious connections do good for many people?
Certainly. But the fact that they do good doesn't necessarily make them true. I think that's an important distinction.
And you started on this because you wanted to understand what it was in a human being's mind that had them so committed to their religion that they would commit suicide in the process of killing thousands of others on 9/11.
Correct.
Was that in part because you have an overall sense that today religion too often is dysfunctional?
Absolutely. I think you only have to pick up a newspaper and look at it. Suicide terrorism, religious prohibitions on stem cell research. And you can go on and on. If you look at the conflicts in the world today, I forget the total number, but the majority of them are religious sectarian conflicts. Look at how much the Middle East torments foreign policy.
So the book, once again, is called Why We Believe in Gods, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. And there's at least one person who's tuned in within the past few minutes and didn't hear everything that we said in the first half hour about all the different kinds of adaptations that you say happened over thousands of years in the human brain.
Well, millions of years.
What can you say to that one person that's going to get the point across in 45 seconds?
Read the book.
Give me a little bit more than that.
Well, again, that we are increasingly close to a comprehensive psychological science of religious belief. It is comprehensible. It doesn't require a scientific education. It's interesting. I think it's fun. I think it's illuminating. And I would encourage people to try to understand. It's part of all of our humanity and the history of the world.
And if nothing else, you may have a better understanding of why you're craving that fast food hamburger and how it relates to what you do or don't think about God. Our guest has been Andy Thompson, or as his full name reads on his new book, J. Anderson Thompson, Jr. Once again, the full title of that book is Why We Believe in Gods, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. Andy, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. By the way, if you like us on Facebook, you'll get access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts as well. Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producer is Bob Levicky, as well as Terry Ward. We had extra help today from Sarah McConnell and Elliot Majerzik and Andrew Windham at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Tony Field at the VFH helped us out, too. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Juspe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.